Welcome to the Women in Manufacturing podcast, where we dive into stories, challenges, and successes shaping the manufacturing industry. Today, we are diving into an incredibly important topic, workplace laws that protect women. Women in manufacturing, like in many industries, face unique challenges from gender discrimination to safety concerns. Understanding legal rights is key to fostering a fair and safe workplace. I'm Ajaswini Parashar, your host for today, and in this episode, we will be speaking with Alexandra Monkhouse, a lawyer who practices employment law and general litigation with a focus on major claims and class actions. She's here to help us break down the legal safeguards available to women, address common workplace challenges, and provide guidance on how to navigate these issues. Hello, Alexandra. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me.
So let's dive in. Workplace harassment isn't always obvious. It can take probably many forms, from verbal and physical harassment to more subtle patterns of discrimination or exclusion. Can you walk us through the different ways workplace harassment can appear and how women can recognize it when they are experiencing it?
Yes. Well, I think to simplify things in terms of sexual harassment, you probably can think of two main categories. First, poisoned work environment, and second, quid pro quo. So quid pro quo would mean that the employment benefits are given contingent upon the employee's participation in some sort of sexual activity. And I would expect that this happens less often than the second type of discrimination, which is the poisoned work environment. So when it comes to poisoned work environment, you can break down harassment in a few subcategories. So you can look at verbal harassment when you have offensive comments, slurs, or inappropriate jokes. And you can have physical harassment, which is the unwanted touching. Of course, you can also have cyber harassment, which is through emails, social media, or texts. And when it comes to the toxic work environment, the harassment can be expressed or implied. As I said, it can be verbal or nonverbal. And it has to be known to be unwelcome. One important thing to keep in mind when considering a poisoned work environment situation is that this situation has to be assessed from the perspective of the objective reasonable bystander, but also from the subjective perspective of the person suffering the conduct. So, when it comes to poisoned working environment, except for particularly egregious situations, standalone incidents would not necessarily create the repeated serious behavior that would rise to the level of the poison work environment.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That was really insightful. Can you probably give us an overview of the key workplace laws that protect women in manufacturing and that every working woman should know?
Yes, well, I think it's important to realize that in Canada, we are a common law jurisdiction. So you have the statute, you have the written law, but you also have the common law. And I think it's important for women in manufacturing to keep this distinction in mind when thinking of what remedies they have. So when it comes to the written law, as I call it, the statute, women can look at human rights legislation. So essentially all provinces in Canada have human rights codes that prohibit harassment based on particular expressed codes, and sex is one of those particular grounds. Then you have minimum standards legislation. And when I say minimum standards legislation, I mean employment standards legislation. And in some provinces, in particular in Prince Edward Island and in Quebec, there are certain types of harassment that are prohibited in these employment standards legislations. So for example, in PEI in Quebec, in particular, sexual harassment is expressly prohibited. And in Quebec, the employee has the right to be free from psychological harassment at work. But these are, you know, two provinces that have these provisions in their minimum employment standards regulations. And then the third type of statute that women would have access to is the occupational health and safety legislation. So in most jurisdictions, harassment is prohibited under these occupational health and safety standards. And if there are any violations, you can make a complaint to the provincial authority enforcing the Ontario, the occupational health and safety legislation. And then the fourth statute that women would have access to is the criminal code. So when it comes to harassment, it is actually a criminal offense when it causes the victim to fear for their safety, or if anyone known to the victim fears for their safety. So if the harassment raises to that level, there would be access to prosecution by the Crown under the criminal code. So these are realistically the law, the written laws that women would have access to. But then there's also the judge-made law, which is called the common law. And I think it's really important for women to know that there are protections created by court cases when it comes to the employment relationship. So under the common law, in addition to all the statutes that I just listed, there can be liability for the employer for harassment in various situations. And I'm going to give you some examples. So there's a common law duty of fairness. The employer has to treat their employees fairly. If they don't treat them fairly, then there would be liability there. So to the extent that there's harassment resulting in a breach of the employer's duty to treat their employee fairly, that could be something that a court could give damages for. Then the second common law remedy that you'd have access to is the tort of intentional infliction of mental suffering. So this is a situation where there's a flagrant and outrageous conduct that is calculated to produce harm and also results in a provable injury. So the standard is high, but in very serious cases of harassment, you may be able to claim under this tort of intentional infliction of mental suffering. Then also under the common law, you have the tort of battery. So for example, sexual battery is a type of battery, and that involves the use of force in the form of physical contact that is harmful or offensive. And there can be damages awarded by courts, depending on the severity of the circumstances for that tort. And I want to end my little discussion here of judge-made remedies with the clarification that under Ontario law, there is actually no freestanding tort of harassment. So you'd have protections for harassment, as I listed under statute, under these various torts. But when it comes to harassment in the employment context as a standalone tort in Ontario, this tort has not been recognized. However, there are situations where employers, because they have to have anti-harassment policies in certain provinces or under federal jurisdiction, they would include protections from the statute in their contract. And when that happens, you would actually have access to a third type of remedy for harassment, which would be under the employer's policy. So just to kind of sum up, people can look at statutes, can look at judge-made remedies, and then they can also look at any contractual promises that were made in their anti-harassment policies that are applicable at work.
I hope it's helpful to our listeners. So, Alexandra, since you are already practicing, what would you say are the most common legal issues that women in male-dominated industries face?
I would say there are mainly four types of concerns. So you'd have hostile work environments and sexual harassment. Then there's pay disparity. That's discrimination. It doesn't rise to the level of harassment, but that is a common legal issue that is present. Then you also have situations where women are discriminated because they're pregnant or they lack accommodations. And there's also the potential of retaliation once people report harassment or discrimination. So these are the four main issues, I'd say.
This was amazing in understanding the workplace protections, but now let's dive into harassment a bit more. So harassment remains a major concern for women, right? So what legal protections exist for women facing workplace harassment?
When a woman faces workplace harassment, realistically, the types of remedies really depend on the nature of the harassment, the degree of aggressiveness, the period, the time period, and frequency, the age of the victim, and the vulnerability. So when it comes to actual remedies, human rights tribunals can request that policies be written or improved to achieve compliance with the legislation. So they can make the employer do something systemic. They can order damages to the person who complained, including any monetary damages that resulted from this harassment. And they can also award punitive damages. In some jurisdictions, for example, in Saskatchewan, the limit to damages is $20,000 for human rights in the Human Rights Tribunal. But there, in other jurisdictions where there's no limit, the Human Rights Tribunal can award significant damages. So, for example, there's a 2015 Ontario case where the employer had to pay $150,000 for human rights damages, or even a more recent one where the employer had to pay $180,000 damages when there was sexual harassment and there were threats of reprisal. As I said, reprisal previously is when the employer retaliates. It's in response to a complaint, for example. When it comes to court damages, as I previewed before, you have the statute. And then you have the judge-made remedies. Some statutes actually create their own enforcement mechanism. So you can go to, for example, as I mentioned before, the Human Rights Tribunal. So that Human Rights Tribunal is an administrative tribunal that can order the employer to, for example, fix their policies and also give damages. When you only go to court, the employee has access to their individual remedies, right? So their damages for, for example, the tort of intentional infliction of mental harm, but the court cannot order the employer to revamp, for example, their anti-discrimination policy. So that's not something that's available for the court. And also, employees can consider making complaints to the Ontario, to the Occupational Health and Safety Enforcing Authorities. For example, in Ontario, that would be the WSIB, where there are concerns regarding their safety. So those are sort of the remedy, the forms and damages available to people.
So, Alexandra, let's say probably there is a woman who is experiencing harassment but fears retaliations. So, what steps can she take while ensuring her job security is there and she can still get a solution?
Yes, I think that's a very, very important question. So when that happens, I think step number one is to document the incidents with times, dates, witnesses. Of course, you want to have witnesses. It's often difficult to actually have people come and provide evidence because they're afraid for their own job. But to the best of your ability, you should document the incidents as contemporaneously as possible. Then when you feel ready to speak to somebody, because often it's a very large, big shock, it's good to I would say try to talk to an employment lawyer, try to talk to your union representative, somebody who can provide you counsel, and then reach out to the human resources department or supervisor, preferably in writing, so you can have a trail to document everything that is happening. So I would say those are the first three things to think about.
And how can, companies better enforce anti-harassment policies to create a safer work environment for their employees, especially women?
Well, I think it's very important first to have a policy and conduct a training, anti-harassment training with the supervisors, and then have that trickle down to the workforce as well. And it's very important to have a clear and confidential reporting process, right? Because as you asked me before, people fear retaliation. So to the extent that you want your policy to be successful, it's important to make sure that the complainant is feeling safe when they make their complaint. And lastly, I would say it's very important for that policy that you're putting in place to be clear. And I would say it to be a zero tolerance policy, and with clear consequences once harassment is identified. You also should put in place an investigation mechanism, whereby you either have somebody in a house who's trained on how to conduct an investigation, or you hire somebody external to conduct an investigation to get to the bottom of any complaints.
So now let's talk about gender discrimination and unlawful terminations. So have you seen cases of unlawful terminations based on gender bias? And like, what legal recourse would do women have in such situations?
So, as I said, the legal recourse is either to file a wrongful dismissal claim in court, right, or to file a claim with the Human Rights Tribunal when that happens. Often, what I see in practice, it's probably best to go the court route because of the backlog, realistically, in the human rights tribunals, at least in Ontario at this point. And when it comes to the practicalities, I think what's very important is for the person to have, to gather all the evidence that may help their case. So have all your emails, performance reviews available to support your case. And of course, consult with a lawyer before filing yourself in any sort of complaints. So once the termination happens, I would say probably first thing to do is talk to a lawyer to figure out what's the best route, and then most often the best remedy is possibly filing a wrongful dismissal court and claim in dismissal claim in court.
Okay. And what do you think? Like, what should a woman do if she suspects she was passed over for a promotion or pay raise due to gender discrimination?
Well, I think the first step to do is request feedback and ask why you haven't been promoted. And then consider your qualifications compared to the ones that did get the promotion. And then if it seems that the treatment was discriminatory, then you can consider making a complaint. However, as you know, it's often when it comes to promotions, there are a lot of factors that they're taking into account. I would say raising the concerns up the chain is a very important first step, and listening to the feedback that is provided instead of jumping to conclusions right away.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, that should be a case that probably if somebody in this situation, they should first consider probably like looking if like what's happening, if they can figure out why that happened instead of just, yeah, jumping to the conclusion. I guess, yeah, that was amazing. So are there any legal protections against pregnancy discrimination in the workplace?
Yes, so as you know, we have in all our provinces, there's a job protected leave when the person's on maternity or parental leave. And then if the person is terminated because they're pregnant, and for example, we did actually have a court case where it was that was the allegation and we were successful to prove it, then actually the employer is liable to pay significant damages. In that particular case, the employee had been with the company for 4.5 months, and she was awarded 5 months reasonable notice. So realistically, and coverage of the legal costs. So realistically, the employer paid more for terminating the employee than they had paid her when she was there.
So since manufacturing is an industry where safety is paramount, so now let's talk about workplace safety and the legal rights associated with that. So manufacturing jobs often involve physical risks. So how do workplace safety laws specifically address women's concerns here?
Well, as you know, PPE is a very important aspect, and PPE and equipment are very important. That it's very important that they fit it fits properly, and there are occupational safety and healthy regulations that deal with those very practical aspects. Also, employers have to provide a safe work environment, and they have to provide proper facilities. There are also safety protections for people who are their whistleblower protections to a certain extent, to the extent that people are reporting unsafe working conditions. So I think those are important aspects. Another issue to consider when it comes to addressing health at work is in manufacturing, you may have not an insignificant number of workplaces that are unionized. The union can be a very good advocate when it comes to ensuring that work is performed safely, and performing work in a discrimination-free way is part of that mandate.
And now let's say probably there is a woman who feels that her employer isn't addressing the safety concerns in the workplace. So, what are the legal steps she can take in such a situation?
I would say it's a three-prong approach. First, document the safety hazards and report them internally. Then, if that didn't work, you could file a complaint with the worker with the appropriate body. So you could either bring it up with your union if you work in a unionized place, or if not, consider talking to the authority that's enforcing the Ontario the Occupational Health and Safety Act in your respective province. Then, if there's any retaliation that occurs because of you filing the complaint, then you can consider actually filing an individual legal action to protect you from that retaliation.
So, Alexandra, if a woman needs legal support for any reason, what are the first steps she should take in being like in the manufacturing industry?
Yes, I think it's a very good question, because from what I see, I would say maybe 80% of cases are never brought, right? Are never brought to the attention of a lawyer, because people don't think that they have the power to change anything. So I would say the first step when you think you have an issue is, of course, you do your legal research online. But pick up the phone and call an employment lawyer, I would say, is a very important step. The law societies in various provinces, they all have referral numbers that they can provide for people to be put in touch with with an employment lawyer. Or there are also legal clinics. There are a lot of people who are available to chat. So I say, if people feel that there's something wrong, the first thing to do is try to find a sounding board. And often enough, picking up the phone is probably the best way of doing that, rather than, I know there's a lot of fear when it comes to that, but the conversations are confidential, and you probably get some guidance much faster than just looking up online. And then once you've talked to somebody, you can consider if it's a situation where you need legal representation, or if you can make a complaint yourself with an appropriate administrative body.
How can women in manufacturing proactively educate themselves about their rights? Is there like any particular way or something?
Well, actually, I was looking up more resources lately, and the federal government has actually, in September of last year, they've put out a request for proposals for more resources to be developed. So women in manufacturing, you can go on the website of the employment standards of the employment standards enforcement body. It could be the Ministry of Labor in their respective provinces. You can look at the occupational health and safety authorities. There are a lot of blog posts also written by various lawyers providing toolkits, or the human rights tribunals. They also have little cheat sheets on what to do when it comes to discrimination. But I would say the information is, it's plentiful, it's sometimes overwhelming. And to a certain extent, you can join organizations that support women in manufacturing. And I think, the forum is a great way of getting people together and talking about the right issues. But in terms of educating yourself, probably some of the best resources are, the government websites that are available for each province.
So, other than this, are there any recent legal developments or case laws that have improved protections for women in the workplace?
Yes, so in Quebec, actually, recently, there is a new law that has come into force in March of last year. That is called an Act to Prevent and Fight Psychological Harassment and Sexual Violence in the Workplace. And this is a development because Quebec law now, for example, has a regime for that prevents psychological harassment. So that is one important development. When it comes to recent case law, I would say one interesting case has come out from British Columbia. It's a class action concerning the failure to implement an anti-discrimination policy by WestJet. So that's the allegation. And there in British Columbia, the court said that that type of claim can go ahead. So women can have recourse if the employer fails to implement what they promised in their anti-harassment policy. So I think that's an important step forward because it opens up this avenue of, employers have policies. Those policies actually have to be respected, or if not, there may be liability.
So, Alexander, these were all the questions that I had. Are there like any final words or advice for women in the manufacturing sector?
Yes. My final words of advice would be know your rights and speak up. Build a strong network because it's very hard to do it alone. And don't hesitate to pick up the phone and call for legal help if you feel you've been wronged.
Well, thank you so much, Alexandra, for taking the time to speak with me today. This conversation has been incredibly insightful, and I hope it empowers women in manufacturing to stand up for their rights and advocate for a safer and a fairer workplace.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure to meet with you and talk about this very important topic.
So, thank you for tuning in to the Women in Manufacturing podcast. For more episodes, please visit womenincanadianmanufacturing.com.